This is Barbara Baker convening this meeting of the Big Tent Committee on the 25th of February 1921. Not a lot of that I have to say to preface this meeting, and we have a pretty full agenda, so we got to get going. But I do want to welcome our newest member, whose name is Commissioner Fred Kuntz. I think he's going to be a great addition to this committee. This is a difficult committee because we're sort of the utility player. We do the things that affect the whole agency that don't neatly fit into one of the other committees portfolio. And so today we'll be looking at the strategic plan. We'll be talking about science, and then we'll begin to start a discussion on a conservation policy and a mission statement. So with that, do we have Jeff yet? Jeff's late to his own committee. All right.
There.
I'll be late to my own funeral too.
Well, that's okay, because I heard you say that Habitat was your favorite committee earlier, so I get a little jab too.
He was caught up on a school of fish, I can see that.
So, Jeff, I thought on the strategic plan, you could, you could lead us through that discussion. I guess just one more thing before we get started. Is there anything that any commissioners have a burning desire to say something before we get started? Okay, hearing none, go ahead, Jeff. Can't wait to hear what you have to say.
Yeah, so Rob's going to be saying most of it. but we wanted to just kind of bring you up to speed on the progress that we've made since the commission adopted the strategic plan. So diving into some of the near-term actions that Amy and Kelly picked out for the director's policy team to kind of shepherd initially. And so Rob's been helping Amy and I kind of scope our projects, and he'll talk with you about that and some of the timeframes. And Nate's been doing an awesome job scoping the near-term action that he has. So he'll be talking to you about that, as well as another big shout out to Nate for helping Rob and I figure out how to best integrate the agency's budget into the strategic plan process, so that what I know in over 20 years at the department is if there's money associated with it, then our culture has a tendency to pay attention to it. So we're trying to really truly make sure that we're all living by this strategic plan as we get it out of the gate. So with that, Rob, if you don't mind pulling up what you have.
Yeah, thank you, Jeff. And hello, commissioners. So to kick this off, what I think I'm going to do is show you our strategic plan, or more specifically, we have four strategies in the plan. And if you remember, for each of our strategies, we identify near-term actions, what we're calling near-term actions, things we want to do in the next 4 years for the plan. There's 34 of them. And one thing we recognize off the bat, as we're thinking 25 years in the future, we don't want to tackle everything all at once. And so there's a little bit of sequencing here. Which of those 34 do we think is best to start with? And it's about 10 plus that we've picked, and I'm going to show those to you. I say plus because when we get to the engagement strategy, it isn't so clean cut, and I'll explain that when we get there. So I'm going to share my screen. Okay. Just as a check, Jeff, are you seeing a cover of the strategic plan on your screen?
Yes, sir.
That's good.
All right. So again, just to refresh your memory on the four strategies that this plan covers, first one really addressing conservation, second one engaging our communities, third one matching the science to our needs. And the fourth one is an internal look at our operations. So I'm going to take you to the near-term actions page for our conservation strategy. Of course, it goes blank on me now. I don't know if this is a...
loading thing. You might need to just give it a minute.
Yeah. In the meantime, I'm going to look for an alternative way here to show it to you. I'm going online to the website.
Hey, Jeff, sometimes it's easier for the presenter to have to let Nikki's really good at this stuff. So if you want to just send it to her and tell her where to go, she'll put it up for you.
Yeah, thanks, Commissioner. I'm going to close it down and try and reopen it again. Sorry about the inconvenience.
Rob, you'll just have to speed talk.
Yeah, well.
10.1 minutes, so.
Okay.
You have the four pager, Rob?
No, it was the full plan, and I'm going to have to go to the website, I think, rather than the document I had downloaded.
Well, one of the things that you all might not know about Rob is that he's famous for telling jokes at UT. And so while Rob is looking for this, I will share with you all a joke appropriate for, you're going to miss it. I'll have to share it with you later.
Okay. Do you see my screen?
Yes.
Okay.
Rob, okay. I just shared it here for you. Here, man.
Oh, you didn't, Nate?
Yeah, I've got it up. Just where do you want it to, where do you want to go?
All right. So let me see. Okay. Yeah, Nate, if you can go to that page right there. And if you can zoom out just a little bit so we can see the page in its entirety. That page consists of seven near-term actions. And in this particular strategy, Jeff is our primary executive sponsor. And we've picked four of these seven to focus on initially. And I'll highlight those here. So thank you, Nate. Number one, we're focusing on the statewide conservation roadmap. Number three, co-manager habitat work plan. Number four, the state hatchery monitoring and evaluation plan. And then the last one, number seven, the climate resiliency plan. So those are the four for this strategy we're focusing on first. Next, Nate, can I ask you to go and zoom ahead to this next strategy, the engagement strategy? There we go. So this one's got 14 near-term actions. And this is the one that's not quite so clean cut, where we can pick out which near-term actions we want to focus on first. And Nate's going to give you a little more detail on that. We think we want to hire some expertise to help us figure this out. Nate, I don't know if this is the appropriate time to turn it over to you, or if you'd rather I get through the four strategies and then we'll come back to you.
Maybe why don't we just keep rolling here, Rob, and then I'll come back.
All right. So if we'll go to the third strategy or science strategy, please. All right. So out of these four near-term actions, we're really focused on the first one right now. And what's going to be the science policy framework? And that's a topic Amy's going to talk to you more in detail after we go over the strategic plan here. And then Nate, if last but not least, when we're looking internally, there's five we're focusing on in here. The first one is number four, and number five, they're linked. It's improving how we take advantage of diversity. Then we've got the next one is number 7. We're focusing on employee satisfaction. Then number 8, where we're looking at our own internal sustainability plan. And then number 9, with an eye on our internal physical and emotional safety. So that's kind of a summary of, with all 34 near-term actions, which ones we're starting with first. And I want to pause here for any questions before I turn it over to Nate to give you a little more detail on the engagement strategy. Okay. So Nate, I don't see any questions. So would you like to share what you have for us?
Great.
Oh, actually, Nate, I see you go up. Commissioner.
Yeah, I was sorry. I had a little trouble raising my hand. So back to the conservation strategy. I didn't see that number 5 was highlighted, as I recall. There's some bullets underneath number 5, work collaboratively with local governments, landowners, and other stakeholders to pursue net ecological gain and additional resources to support management and land use planning that encompasses fish and wildlife conservation. And there's SHB 1117, which we're supporting. Did we work collaboratively with local governments, landowners, and other stakeholders in working on this bill?
Commissioner Thorburn, the answer is absolutely yes. Over the last year and a half, the prime sponsor of the bill, because this is not an agency request bill, but we have been providing technical support to Representative Lekanoff, and she had a a version of this bill came up last session. And prior to that, she'd been working with local governments, tribes, landowners, business, farmers. That bill died, but she kept us all sitting around the table in the interim to develop the bill that you see now, the substitute House Bill 1117. It does have local government support. One of the key factors of that support is that we also are pushing for funding for local governments' growth management planning capacity and compliance capacity as part of that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Well, Rob, why don't I'll go ahead and walk through a little bit of the details here on the second strategy regarding engaging communities through engagement, or it's through conservation and stewardship. So we have created a cross-program team. There's a number of folks within the director's office on that. Jeff, Carrie, myself. A couple RDs, one from the east side, Mike Livingston, and then Larry Phillips from the west side. We've got the major programs represented, as well as Marvin Williams, our diversity, equity, inclusion manager. So pretty fun group, mix of executives, and there are some practitioners on there in terms of outreach practitioners. And really what we're trying to do is stay coordinated as an agency here as we move through different outreach initiatives. Currently, I would say our state of affairs right now is on outreach, and this is not faulting anyone, just the assessment. We lack a comprehensive, prioritized approach for how we do outreach and engagement as an agency. Our outreach work units are distributed throughout programs and throughout the state. That's important because you want to have that community touch point, but it also leads to potentially inconsistent statewide messages, or one work unit is designing a survey for the public and another work unit's designing a survey for the public and we haven't talked. And so we're really trying to have this internal team bring those various initiatives together. And I think overall for an agency this size and given the breadth of our mission, I think it's fair to say that we are very under-resourced when it comes to outreach. When you look in the past of how the agency has addressed budget cuts, and I'm going back here a little bit, even 09-11. And, you know, when you have those choices of, do you close down a hatchery or do you trim an outreach program? Well, you trim the outreach program. And I think over the years of doing those kinds of reductions has left where you have a pretty small, high-performing team that is, we're asking the world of those folks, and we need to offer them some support. So when we look through the list of the near-term actions, 14 of them there, I'm not saying that we're pausing on our outreach work, far from it. I am wanting to add some capacity to help us with this overall assessment so that we are poised to deliver on those 14 near-term objectives, as well as to deliver on the 25-year vision that you all have adopted in our strategic plan. So in terms of our strengths, my gosh, we've got great staff. The folks in public affairs, our Hunter Ed unit, our community coordinator and enforcement programs have outreach expertise, our sales and marketing team and the licensing division. They are go-getters, they are ambitious, and they are moving mountains for us. Also, what's really nice in working in an agency like Fish and Wildlife is we are content rich. Our work fascinates the public. You know, we do not have to try to necessarily sell our news releases. Our stuff gets picked up. When the director decides to have an open house in a region, you know, we can pack a room. So there's a lot of energy and interest on our topics. And then also, besides for those staff that are paid as outreach practitioners, there's an expectation that all of us as department employees have a role in outreach. And we have some phenomenal spokespersons. Grab almost anybody from enforcement. Oh my gosh, put them in front of the camera. They do a great job articulating the department's mission and their role. So we've got a lot to work with, but I wanted to share that landscape as far as at a broader kind of policy level, we're needing some assistance. So we're in the process right now of editing a request for proposals that I'm hoping to have posted next week, to bring on a consultant that will help us as a near-term task assess our capacity and trying to get that done here this summer so we can inform the development of our 2022 supplemental budget. And secondly, to develop a strategic engagement plan. Really, what are our priorities for engaging the public? And then some of those items that are in the near-term actions fit within that. As far as for a commission engagement on this process, I envision that having the consultant conduct interviews with the nine commissioners to get your all's input on how we're doing as an agency. You as our board of directors, give us feedback on what you think how we're doing and where should we improve. And then also I expect to have a draft of that strategic engagement plan in November. Would like to bring that in front of the commission in December. So talk to Kelly about those timelines and those touch points. Thought that sounded good. And so wanted to pause here and see, get any reaction here from the big tent that we can include in this process.
May I have your hand up?
Yeah, Commissioner Thorburn.
Hi, thanks, Nate. Yeah, outreach is so important, and you know, I think we're really making leaps and bounds. The curricula that's been developed, I'm glad to see the attention being paid to this. The other part, sort of clump of activities, near-term activities in this area is our advisory committees sort of work, and you know, they're an important part of the engagement, public engagement that we've used. And so there's one strategy about, you know, trying to improve how they function. And then there's another one that I'm really interested in, and that's the regional advisory groups. That would be sort of a new venture. I hold that in high priority, and I'm wondering where that one is.
Yeah, thanks, Commissioner Thorburn. So as I indicated that, while we're going to be doing this RFP, we're certainly not hitting pause on all of our day-to-day outreach work, as well as a number of initiatives. And so wanted to just share with you, here's some of the things that we're doing on a concurrent basis. We're actively right now, you asked about reviewing our advisory handbook, but we're also going to be conducting an assessment of the number of our advisory groups. Whether an advisory group should is at a level that needs a staff lead, or maybe we swap out staff. So you have a staff person from wildlife helping facilitate a conversation about Columbia River, and a Columbia River staff person maybe helping facilitate a conversation about our recreation strategy, just so that there's still a staff person, but allows the staff that are at the meeting to be the subject matter experts and engage and have someone else do the facilitation role, or as an advisory group such that we really need to contract out and have an external third party neutral. And then your question about the regional advisory groups, that is one of the near term actions, and that's something that we are gonna proceed with doing this year. So I hope that addressed your question, Commissioner Thorburn.
Thank you.
So Fred has his hand up, Nate.
Yes, okay. I appreciate the increase in the outreach materials that you've been doing. For example, the shrub set video was really fantastic. But with my big tent hat on, I don't have the graphic that Don has, but I wear a hat next time. But with my big tent hat on, when you're working on the strategy over the next few months, I know that you've been reaching out a little bit to some partner organizations, but there is a sensitivity out there in the other NGOs that this is an area like I used to work at the zoo, for example, but it goes further than just the zoo. You know, why not let them do the outreach and I just send them some money, for example,
yeah,
and they would do the outreach. So, you know, I would, and I know you're talking to people and you see that, you know, that partnering is a good use of our money and you're doing that. So I encourage you to think about that and realize that that's a sensitive issue with some of our NGO partners. The other thing when you're developing the other idea for the strategy is to have, if you're gonna have a consultant help you, what are the gaps? Maybe thinking out of the box a little bit, what are some of the gaps in engagement that we could become more expert at? And I'll give you one example. And that's conflict resolution. You know, I don't know if we've ever really thought about engaging our audiences in strategies that really have an ability to start bringing out to the communities discussions about resolving conflict around wildlife issues. Because I think this is something that the other NGOs like the zoo, they're kind of shying away from it. It's too hard. It's, you know, it's easier to talk about the biology of animals and, you know, the wonders of nature. But this might be something for us to think about that could really break new ground that would be, I think, particularly important for the agency and for realizing our dreams of our vision and mission for the agency. Something to think about.
Yeah, Commissioner Kuntz, thank you for both of those observations. On your first one about leveraging partners or just contracting them to do that work, in a discussion with Carrie, our Director of Public Affairs, yesterday, as we were going through the near final version of the draft RFP, that is something that we flagged and incorporated. as asking the consultant to help us to say, okay, these are things that we would want to have a statewide function for. Here's things that we'd want to do more at the regional level. And here's things that's not in our bailiwick. Let's push that out or leverage others. So absolutely, that's something that's going to be considered in that gap analysis. And then on the conflict resolution side, I think we're approaching that in a couple different aspects. One is, how do we better incorporate human dimensions and wildlife values into our decision making? And then secondly, how do we provide staff with more training in their engagement with communities for conflict de-escalation, conflict resolution? We have, over the past, oh, I would say maybe it was 2012, till recently, we had brought on somebody that was a worldwide expert on conflict resolution and helped us out with some wolf management. And it's been a matter of, you know, how do we sustain that skill set internally and how do we apply it to some of our other forums? So that's something else we'll definitely want to look at here as part of this analysis.
So I see Jeff has a comment.
Yeah. One example, Commissioner Kuntz, we've been working, both Habitat Wildlife Program and myself have been working with the governor's office to restore pollinator habitat on the Capitol campus as an example. And one of our strong partners in that, in fact, we do have a contract with them, is Woodland Park Zoo. And so that is one of the areas where they're bringing some expertise to the table, including yeah. how to you know, really nail the educational displays that'll be a component of that project. And the governor and the governor's office is pretty excited about this. I know he's a big pollinator person, so pretty cool to like have the agency doing some work right outside our door and working with partners like the Xerces Society, Audubon, and Woodland Park Zoo.
Great.
Thanks, Jeff. Keep going, Nate.
That's everything that I had prepared, Commissioner Baker. So yeah, we'll get the RFP out here hopefully next week, and we'll keep you all posted here in the Big Tent Committee, especially as we come up on a couple of the action items here with involving commissioner interviews with the consultant.
Thank you. And when do we expect the results of whatever the consultant does?
Yeah, so we're looking at the first part of just the assessment of our current resources, staffing, structure, kind of roles and responsibilities. I'd like to get that completed by the end of July to be able to inform our 2022 budget development. So have that as part of our August budget requests to you for approval in case there's any investments on outreach that have been identified, and then having the broader kind of plan be developed by the end of the calendar year.
Thank you. It looks like Lorna has a question. Commissioner Smith.
Well, you're muted, Commissioner Smith.
Sorry. I was wondering if we're going to be able to see the RFP before or as it goes out. I'd be interested to take a look at that.
Certainly. I'll send you a link here once it's submitted.
Sure. Great.
Thanks. Are we back to Jeff then?
Well, actually, Commissioner, I think it's me.
Back to Rob.
And so that was our overview for the strategic plan and where we're focusing now. Our next item, barring any additional questions, I think Amy's going to spend some time diving more into the science framework portion of our plan. So I'll pause for any other questions and then recommend we go on to Amy, if that's okay.
I would like to ask that, could you please synopsize the numbers on the strategic plan that the agency has decided to focus on in the near term and send it to us for those of us who didn't take good enough notes?
Can do, Commissioner.
Thank you. Lorna, do you still have another question or is your hand still up? Hand disappeared. Okay. Well, that was very efficiently done. Does anybody have any questions about the update on what's happening with the strategic plan before we move on to the science and policy piece of it? This is exactly why you don't want to have these meetings at the end of days, because everybody's already asked all their questions. But as we go through this, I guess I'll leave it up to Amy, but normally in the big tech committee, it's a little less formal than some of the other committees. And so just raise your hand if you have a question as we're going along. So I guess we're going to Amy next.
Okay, great. Thank you, Commissioner Baker. So I am joined today by the team that's helping me scope and think through the initial stages of the science policy interface strategy. So I've got Lynn Helbrecht here with us. Jeff is loaning me Lynn and her amazing expertise as a facilitator and as a project manager. And I have Dr. Tim Quinn, Dr. Jerry Nelson, and Lori Peterson, our three chief scientists from Habitat, Wildlife, and Fish Program. And so they're sort of here as color commentary and to throw their two cents in and to answer any questions about each of the science programs. We didn't have a chance at the orientation to kind of go over the science program, so we might give them just a little bit of time if we have it to talk a little bit about each of their individual programs. So with that, I will start off by sharing my screen. And so Commissioner Kuntz got a preview of this because I gave a similar talk earlier this week at the fish science, the amazing fish science workshop that Lori put on. So Commissioner Kuntz, you have dispensation to grab a cup of coffee if you so desire. But what I'd like to do is I have about 15 slides to talk through how we're approaching the science policy interface at the Department of Fish and Wildlife. All right. So I want to start by just saying that we are hearkening back and grounding this conversation in our conservation principles. These conservation principles were created about 5 years ago or so. They are enshrined in policy. They are essentially our guideposts or our North Stars as we talk internally. Mostly it's an internal set of principles about conservation. So these are the jumping off point to begin our conversation about the science policy interface. So we're going to focus on strategy number three. And in strategy number three is this near-term action: develop, prioritize, and deliver a science policy framework. And for the purposes of our work, we are interchangeably using the word framework and interface. So the science policy interface, and this is, before I put together this talk, I did a review of the literature and asked our librarian to help do some review of literature. I worked with my three chief scientists, and we've been gathering the literature around the science policy interface so that we're using sort of the most recent thinking about it. But essentially, the science policy interface is the process by which various science actors inform policy actors in an iterative exchange or co-production of science questions to inform decision making. So when we start down this path, we start with this idea of, all right, we're going to deliver a science policy framework. And when I think about the framework, it is how we internally are going to work from the science side of our house and the policy side of our house, of which the commission is a key piece of it. And so as we begin to do that, we want to explore, well, okay, what is the role of science in this framework? What is the role of policy? And then what's this interface actually going to look like? So we start with, all right, what is the role of science in this interface? So from the literature and sort of from my own experience, science is is an ability to look into the future. There are a set of headlights that, based on the data, we can flag change for policymakers or for decisions. So they can, you know, when you're thinking about driving down the road, they are lighting up the road in front of us to say, what is coming? What do we need to watch out for? Science adheres to a methodology that minimizes subjectivity throughout the process of development. And that's particularly important for us as a state agency, as a public agency, is that, you know, we need our science to do the best we can, recognizing that no science is value free, but to engage a methodology that minimizes that subjectivity. The other piece is that science is, its role is to help the policy community or decision makers actually understand the complexity of systems. Most of the systems we deal with here at the Department of Fish and Wildlife are incredibly complex, and they are very sensitive to change, and they're sensitive to change over time. And Commissioner Kuntz said something earlier at one of the other committee meetings about looking in the rearview mirror. And the interesting thing about looking in the rearview mirror in order to chart our future is, of course, the past, given climate change, will not look like the future. And so helping us understand that complexity is a key role of science in this interface. And then we want managers to see the range of policy options. We need science to help us understand the implications of the options that policymakers are going to choose amongst. And then what we really need is we need science to help us understand the uncertainty and the risk in a way that helps policy understand the context of the information being provided. So essentially, overall, science is a broker of information that's as unbiased as we can make it. So then what's the role of policy in this interface? Well, policy, there's this idea of a policy window. And the policy window is when a set of circumstances occur that invites change. And that invitation to change is when policy all of a sudden says, oh my gosh, we have a problem. We got to do something right now. The window opens, and into that is this opportunity for science to really engage more directly with policy. It's also where policymakers set the North Star. They are the goal setting piece of this interface. And the integral part of that goal setting is value-based. It's a value-based process, right? Goals are based on the values that we are choosing amongst. And then policy has to weigh the trade-offs. At its simplest, policymaking is about making choices between different options. And these different options are going to affect stakeholders in different ways. And they are going to have different consequences. And many of those consequences are going to be, we're not going to know what they are, and they're going to be, there's going to be uncertainty around them. So when I think about the science policy interface, you know, there's this metaphor, follow the science. If we just follow the science, and this is something that we hear from the public, and we certainly hear it from others that we interact with. And I really see that as a bit of a failed metaphor, because it's not about following the science, it's about informing the policy. And there's this common misconception among non-scientists that science can provide objective answers to the thorniest question, which is, how should we manage this ecosystem? Or how should we manage this resource or this species? But inherently, the how to manage the ecosystem or a species is a choice for the policymakers, because the how is about the values. How much money, with what level of uncertainty, to determine what trade-offs, to impact which stakeholders. All of that is in the how we manage. So this is a question that, we wrestled with a lot when we were developing the riparian science document that Tim and the Habitat Science team developed. And there were stakeholders that said, hey, scientists, tell us how much riparian area we need. How much? Is it 200 feet? Is it 150 feet? Is it 99 feet? How much? And Tim was quite rigorous and vigorous in his response, which is that we cannot answer that question without the values conversation. And the values conversation is, what are we protecting the riparian area for? What is the purpose of it? And if that purpose is determined by policy, and then scientists can help. So if the purpose of the riparian area is to provide robust salmon habitat, then it's a specific answer, right? So it's about, you got to connect the purpose in order to understand what the science needs to deliver. So this is a tidy little set of boxes and arrows. And of course, nothing ever looks quite this tidy. But I want to draw your attention to the demand and the supply idea. And essentially that on the left-hand side of this is the policy side, and on the right-hand side is the science side. And what I want to highlight is that this is a conversation. It's an iterative conversation of co-developing the questions and the knowledge. And it's done through policy demanding science and answers and information, and science supplying it. And it's in that dialogue that we find the interface and the robustness. And that's really what I'm pretty excited about at the department, is trying to get way more intentional about this iterative conversation that's going to happen between our science side and our policy side. So just one example of a really robust science policy interface was the Southern Resident Killer Whale Task Force. So, you know, the Southern residents have been, they've been in trouble for a while. You know, this isn't like it just happened the other day. But what did happen the other day, and this is where the policy window opened, was there was a mama orca whose baby orca died. And that mama orca then carried that baby orca around on her nose for 17 days. It was like a big billboard of crises that everybody could see. And with that came a big push on the policy side to articulate clear values about what we wanted and how we wanted to recover the species. And that then generated this opportunity for an iterative conversation between the policy side and these technical teams. And what was so extraordinary about this particular science policy interface is that the technical teams were very good listeners. They listened very closely to the questions that came out of the policy side. There was this scaffolding of information where the technical teams didn't assume that the policy side knew everything, and they built and they built and they built the understanding. And then we would revisit that information and revisit the decisions as our understanding from the policy side became, as we became more sophisticated in the understanding and the language that was essentially given to us from the technical side. And there was really good characterization of scientific uncertainty. So it was I personally, it's sort of like of all the science policy interfaces that I've been part of, I thought it was one of the most robust. And I think the results of that interface have been equally robust. I mean, we've seen investments from the legislature. We've seen all of the state agencies pulling in the same direction. We've seen NGOs pulling in the same direction. We've seen really significant investments. So it worked, I guess I would say. Like, you know, are we going to recover the orcas? You know, we need another probably 10 years to know, but I think the groundwork was laid by that interface. Okay, so that's the framework, sort of conceptually. So what do we do now? So here's where we're at now, is that this is a short list of a much longer list of questions that I think we need to start developing. This is where the chief scientists have been really helpful, is to sort of start laying out what are the questions we at the department need to explore. So do we agree on the role of science and policy and the policy and science? Do we collectively, internally, can we articulate it, and do we agree with it? What is the level of trust in DFW science? I mean, I think this is this gets into the credibility component of it. And I've spoken with multiple commissioners about this. And this is I know it's a concern internally, and I think it's a concern externally, is that make sure we have a very high level of trust. Do we know our science priorities within and across programs? This strategy says that we are going to work on the most pressing issues facing fish and wildlife. That means that we need to know what those priorities are, and then how do we articulate and align our science priorities around what policy needs? Are we doing science in a way to deliver on our priorities? Is it interdisciplinary? Is it cross-program? Is it synthetic? Do we understand what it takes to create an effective science policy interface? And do we have the skills for it? That leads to sort of the next question, like, all right, well, what are the skills we need? So on the science side, we got to maintain and continue to grow our expertise in relevant science disciplines. We need scientists who are effective communicators. We need scientists who can effectively communicate complexity and uncertainty simply, but with integrity. We need the ability to design and execute high quality science using best practices. We need to use the methodologies that are the best practices for the questions we're asking. And then we need to engage in this iterative conversation. on the policy side, policy's got to be clear about the goals they're shooting for. We got to wrestle. We need policymakers who can wrestle with complexity without eliminating nuance, focusing on the trade-offs and stakeholder impacts, because the stakeholder impacts are not the same across all the trade-offs. We need to understand, we need policymakers to understand what science can deliver and what it cannot deliver, and to deal with that inevitable uncertainty. We need policymakers to understand the role of adaptive management, and to then again engage in this iterative conversation. And all of that iterative conversation is a time-consuming conversation that we need to commit to for the big things we wrestle with. So as we start walking down this path, this is from a paper on EBM, ecosystem-based management. And I think this could be the beginning of principles for our science policy framework, or perhaps a criteria. We haven't really wrestled it to the ground, but it's this idea that the science that we're doing for the science policy framework, is it salient? Is it responsive to the science policy interface? Is it responsive to societal needs? Legitimacy. Has the process been legitimate, and has it engaged the right folks? This gets into fairness and balance. This starts to touch on diversity, equity, inclusion. This talks about fairness. And then credibility. Is the work perceived as scientifically adequate? Is the knowledge that's being exchanged done in such a way that it has integrity? Is it robust? Is the science robust, essentially? And so that's the framework. And so where we are right now is just at the very beginning. And I want you to, sort of envision Julie Andrews spinning in the hills right now. It's a very good place to start. So we've convened the three chief scientists. We're starting to develop our scope of work. We then need to engage our broader science staff and our policy staff in the products and in the process. And the timeline's a little vague at this moment because we haven't yet finished the scope of work, but we're hoping to engage more broadly beyond the chief scientists in spring, summer, and have some preliminary products in fall and winter. So that is the general plan. And I want to end with a quote, because I think this is a really good way to sum it up. It says, "Nevertheless, adherence to a methodology that minimizes subjectivity throughout the process of knowledge development is perhaps the greatest distinction between the scientific and non-scientific arguments employed in support of policy decisions. This claim to objectivity is the basis for the public authority entrusted to science and for the privileged role that science plays in informing policy." And in my mind, that idea that science holds a privileged place in public dialogue is essential. It's true. And it is then essential that we have credible science, like that we, the department, are really having our science has integrity and that it's robust, so that we can stand in that privileged place with honesty and with sort of like a robustness to it. And we can talk, from this place, from this quote, we can jump off and have other conversations about, all right, what is the challenge around science advocacy? And what are some of our problems when we have science being used as a proxy for really what is a values debate? And we can use this thought piece, if you will, to sort of lead us into these other directions. And I am looking forward to traveling them with staff and with you. So I will stop there. Here's some references, we will make this available, of course. That quote came from the AFS article here. So I am going to stop sharing. All right. So Commissioner Baker, I'm happy to take any questions. I'm also happy to introduce the chief scientists. However you see it.
Well, of course, if there's questions, we should ask questions, but I'd like to say that's a remarkable and short and to the point presentation. And I really appreciate it, because I think sometimes all of us especially those of us who are looking for an outcome, get a little confused about the place the policy and science plays in the equation. So thank you very much for that. Anybody with questions should raise their hand. I'm hoping for just a tiny bit more. Okay, and Kim has her hand up. When we get to the chief scientists, not only in face and a name, but if they could just say a few words, just tell us what they do, and maybe, you know, I don't know that they're brave enough to tell us, you know, how they perceive what we should do, just a little bit of a discussion from them would be great. And, you know, we don't have tons of time, but we have some. So Commissioner Thorburn, your hand is up.
Yeah, thanks, Barbara. And thanks, Amy. Really appreciated your thinking on this and the chief scientists. Very interesting. I see that the focus is on our own science practice within the department. There are some areas where we do broad reviews, most typically with the status reports of various species, but there are others. We've done the hatchery science review, and now we're looking at the cougar management review. Sometimes the feeling that you know, our science is the science. I think when we're working on policy, and would just encourage that, you know, science is a very collaborative peer kind of practice, and that maybe that be captured a little bit in your thinking about the interface of science and policy.
Thank you, Commissioner. I'm not sure how. Yeah, I guess what I took away from what you said is that the science. So this, to ensure that as we talk about the science policy interface, we are inclusive of the full body of science and not exclusive of science that or don't focus on just DFW science, right? That the body of science is the body of science, and it stretches much further than the walls of our imagination just here in the department.
Thank you. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I'm with you on that one. So I guess I'll just start with Tim, because you're just right below me there on the screen, and then we'll go to Lori and then Jerry. So Tim, why don't you say who you are, a little bit about what your program does, what you're focused on, and maybe a few sentences about the science policy interface and how you see it, perceive it.
Okay, great. Thank you. Hello, commissioners. Nice to meet you all. And thanks for participating in this. I think the science policy interface discussion is a really important one, and particularly growing in importance as our world grows smaller. And as issues become more complex and there's more stakeholders involved in every issue that we undertake. I'm with the Habitat program, and I've been the chief scientist since the beginning of chief scientists back in 2000 or so. And at the time, it was really to try to bring a little bit of organization to our science endeavors and certainly credibility to our science endeavors. That is overseeing some of the science that we do necessarily to deal with our issues. I did want to respond to the commissioner that talked just before it got turned over to us, and that is sort of the collaborative piece. One of the great things that the chief scientists have done since they were sort of designed is to work across boundaries. We work closely with the co-op units at University of Washington and WSU. We do collaborative projects with many of the universities. We do collaborative projects with other nonprofit organizations. We are really outreach specialists to try to expand our influence by expanding the stakeholders that can contribute to the science. And that has been a really successful aspect of having chief scientists in my mind. I guess I you know, some of the things that I'm doing, I think I'm the smallest group of scientists in the agency. I think we have about 20 full-time staff and up to 15 or 20 seasonal staff. We have brought in over $20 million of grant money over the last 20 years, and we've been extraordinarily successful. Most of that grant money gets turned into incredibly relevant topics to the Habitat program. And they also often meet a peer review standard. So a lot of our science gets peer reviewed and published in the leading scientific journals, for which we're very proud. I guess the other thing that I'm very proud about is the inclusion of adaptive management within our program. So we have a regulatory program called the Hydraulic Permit Authority, where we regulate all activities that affect the bed or flow of state waters. And over the past maybe 10 years, we've implemented an adaptive management program that feeds information back on how we do as a permitting agency and how our permits actually, how effective they are in the field. So there's plenty of work to do. I'm delighted to be in the big tent with you and would love to talk to you more over the coming months and years. Thank you.
So Tim, just because you didn't say it, you're the chief scientist of the Habitat program. And
I think I said that.
Did you say I missed it? Okay, good. And then I also wanted to, Commissioner Coons had raved about Jane Aetha. So I wanted you to know that and connect the dots for Commissioner Coons said, the work that was done on climate change came out of your shop, and it's been a national model, and it's a pretty impressive work.
Well, thank you, Amy. I hate to brag on that, but we won a national award on that project for, and Jane was a key player, but we basically worked with the Climate Impacts Group at the University of Washington, one of those collaborations. We got a grant from another group that was involved with climate change, and I can't remember the name right now, but working with that big partnership and three of our internal staff, we were able to come up with a tool that projects future stream flows. And because culverts, we permit culverts, and because culverts can last 100 years, we believe that it's important that they try to accommodate future in-stream flows. And that was what our project was all about. And it's been remarkably successful. And I would just say that counties and cities who also do put in culverts have come to us for our tool, not because we regulate them, but because they had no other tool to use to project these stream flows. So we're very proud of that. Thanks, Amy, for the cue.
Thank you, Tim. And hold where you are, because you have a couple of questions. First is Commissioner Thorburn. Oh, well, you might have three questions.
I just wanted to demonstrate my seniority on the commission and actually recall a wonderful presentation of that work, and just also acknowledge that your little unit is nationally recognized for its culvert work. And I think you should be willing to express that and brag on it.
Well, thank you. I don't know if my red color is showing in my face. I suppose it depends on the tint, but I'm blushing here. Thank you so much for that. It was extraordinarily gratifying to be recognized, and also by you as well. Thank you.
All right. I see two other hands, but I can't tell who they are. Nikki, can you tell me?
Thing. I've got.
I see Jeff and Jeff. Lorna.
Yeah, Jeff
Commissioner,
and Lorna.
Commissioner Smith.
Okay, well, so Lorna, hang on just a second and let Jeff make a comment, and then you'll be next. Jeff.
Thank you, Commissioner Baker. I just super, super quick. Jane is amazing. Tim's whole team is amazing. But I also want to put on your radar Dr. Ken Pierce. Developed high resolution change detection. And that sounds kind of funky, yet we're contacted almost regularly by Microsoft as they figure out how to do what Dr. Pierce has done to apply it globally. So Tim and and Dr. Pierce have really been working closely with Microsoft, and I think there's a lot more application there between Microsoft and our science work moving forward. So.
All right. Okay. So we have Commissioner Smith, Lorna.
I just want to say that I've heard recently about several award-winning research projects the department has either done solely or in partnership. And I believe pretty strongly we should be blowing our horn really loud and wide when this happens with press releases to the legislature in particular. You know, it's big stuff when we're out there on the cutting edge and getting recognized for it. And we need to make sure that that's a known fact. So congratulations on that. And I look forward to more of the same.
Thanks, Lorna.
Okay, thank you very much, Commissioner.
All right, okay, excellent. Let's go to, I think, Lori, you were going to go next.
Yeah, good afternoon, everyone. I'm Lori Peterson, the Chief Scientist of FISH Program, and it's really great to be here under the big tent, so to speak. Yeah, so I'd like to share my screen. I prepared a overview of the FISH Science Division and our key projects, units, staff, and so forth. Is that okay, Amy, to share screen? All righty. Great. So who we are, I have here. Can y'all see the screen?
Mm-hmm.
So we're, to sum it up, a key leader in Washington State FISH scientific development, conducting research, monitoring, and evaluation in support of salmon recovery, fisheries management, hatchery mitigation operations, as well as hydro mitigation, habitat restoration, among other things. So we work to provide the best available science as specified in our state RCWs for conservation and management of salmon and steelhead. And we work as research advisors for monitoring the status and trends of fish populations, fish health, genetics. We have aging labs, otoliths, and scale labs. We have information systems that are fish specific. Data management, modeling, and statistical analysis experts, biometricians. And our customers, I worked on this for Amy, are quite diverse. You can see here, I won't list them all, but we have, like Tim mentioned, many collaborative partnerships with universities. We've got like Salish Sea Marine Survival Project with Long Live the Kings, Canada's Pacific Salmon Foundation, of course, like things like Pacific Salmon Commission, North Pacific Anadromous Fish Commission, the Public Utility Districts, Bonneville Power Administration, on and on throughout the state. And of course, the public. We have a salmon status and trends data dashboard that has basically all the populations we have data on throughout the state and their abundance over time. And fishing guide apps the public uses, that based on the smartphone that have all the regulations, fishing regulations, and even our fishing guides for steelhead have been using a new fishing guide app. So pretty proud of the diversity of our work. We've got approximately 200 employees deployed statewide in headquarters, regions, district offices, local offices throughout the state. And our key program areas, we have six overall program areas. One is research, monitoring, and evaluation. And it's separated geographically. We have our whole Eastern Washington science and then Western. And this includes RME for salmon recovery, fisheries management, a lot of the hatchery mitigation and operations work, especially on the east side. The Columbia is a big part of our work in hydro mitigation. And then we have our laboratories, research and operations. This includes our molecular genetics laboratory, otolith lab, fish aging or scale lab, big fish health program as well. There are veterinarians, epidemiologists go out to the hatcheries ensuring the health of our released salmon populations. Yeah, so they serve this the whole state and across fish, wildlife, and habitat programs. Again, fish health, we've got 83 state hatchery facilities that we serve on treating pathogens and disease. Mentioned our information technology and GIS support specific to fish, including catch databases, harvest, and escapement or trends back to particular watersheds, status and trends, and mapping of those. We have statistical and biometric support. I'd like to build this more. When I entered the agency, it was 23 years ago now. I can't believe it. We had 6 biometricians in fish program. They were able to serve, you know, and consult on study designs and analysis of data with a statistical kind of PhD level background. Would love to get more. We're down to 1 now, although a lot of other staff have quantitative skills, but would like to build that section up. And then of course, Columbia River Science and Policy Coordination, coordinate with Northwest Power and Conservation Council, Bonneville Power Administration, and the salmon recovery organizations throughout the state. So I'm proud of our work at the Science Policy Interface and that our deputy director is leading this group. We've had a few meetings, well, 2 meetings so far, and have done work individually as chief scientists, you know, collecting literature and sharing with each other. And it's just been a great think tank on how we can improve in that regard. And we just had the fish science division meeting for 2.5 days earlier this week. And that was a really good meeting, such high caliber presentations of fish science going on throughout fish program and in habitat program. We had Jane Atha as a guest presenter in our climate change topic area. And Amy came and gave the presentation she just gave you all, which started a really meaningful discourse on that science policy interface topic and work we can do there. So anyway, that's our overview, and I'll take any questions or comments.
Unshare your screen for us, Lori, so we can
see. Oh, sorry about that.
No worries.
Commissioner Kuntz has a question or comment.
Yeah, just we're giving out a lot of praise today. And Lori, I was able to listen in on some of the fish science meeting. It was excellent.
Okay.
And I know it was recorded, and I really would recommend the other commissioners, besides seeing Jane's great presentation and we saw Amy's today, is I really, Lori, got a lot out of Sue Grant from Canada's presentation.
Yeah, me too.
Keynote speaker the first day. And because I think it has implications well beyond fish and just about everything we do in the department. So anyway, kudos to you and the team.
Thank you. Yeah, I'll put the link here for you guys in the chat on where the materials are. It's out on the S drive under all agency shared project. And we've got Sue Grant's presentation and all the other different presenters as PDF files. Amy, I still need your file, but
oh, I'm sorry. I'll send that to you. And you know, let's stick it on the internet, but you and I can figure that stuff out.
Yeah.
Okay.
But thanks, Fred, for coming, or Commissioner Kuntz. It was really great to see you there.
Awesome. Thanks, Lori. So now I want to invite Jerry Nelson to talk a little bit about the wildlife program and his staff.
Good afternoon, commissioners. I'm Jerry Nelson. I'm the chief scientist for the wildlife program. It's good to see some of you again. I've seen you a few times in my old job. Tim and Lori covered a lot of what science divisions do within the program, but I'll just add a little bit of foundation for the wildlife program. We have responsibilities in all the terrestrial wildlife and some marine wildlife, especially marine mammals and marine birds. We have an east side research team. We have a west side research team. We have the data management and data stewardship work unit. And we also have the GIS work unit. And we also have the wildlife health folks. And so we have 2 veterinarians working in the wildlife program as well. I'll see if I can share my screen a little bit. The 2 things that I wanted to highlight is, one is, find it here. Right. Can you see that?
Yes.
Okay. One of the things that I wanted to stress was two recent impactful projects that you all are probably familiar with that have origins in the Wildlife Program Science Division. One you've seen a lot about, and that's the work that both Wildlife Program and Fish Program have been doing when it comes to pinnipeds and salmon consumption by pinnipeds in the Puget Sound. Some really tremendous work being conducted by the collaboration between Scott Pearson and Joe Anderson of the Fish Program. And that's soon culminating into a paper that'll be submitted to the Canadian Journal of Fisheries and Aquatic Sciences. And so we're really, really proud of that, and a lot of cross collaboration with those co-authors on that paper, University of British Columbia, NOAA, Long Live the Kings, on and on like that, and several Western Washington University, and of course, a lot of talented people from our agency. The other one I wanted to mention was the Sagebrush Passerine Bird Survey. Some of you may have had a chance to see that presentation. It surfaced here recently in some Audubon meetings, but that was a multi-year volunteer citizen science kind of project that was really quite successful. And we can provide those links for you folks to take a look at that. But we had a lot of collaboration between one of our senior research scientists, Matt Vanderhagen, and Audubon Washington, local Audubon chapters, and of course, our agency. And those are really, really important, impactful efforts that we're proud of. The other thing I wanted to stress, and Lori stressed some of this as well, is we are a service division, and we provide service and support to a lot of different entities, including the other divisions within the wildlife program, but also the fish and habitat programs, also you all, the director's office, licensing, a whole suite of federal collaborators and state agency collaborators, a lot of collaboration with various tribal natural resource entities, and also a lot of collaboration with the universities, UW, WSU, WSU Vancouver, Western Washington University, and a key role and key liaison with the Washington Cooperative Research Unit. I'm sure some of you are familiar with that, others maybe not so much, but co-op units are housed at universities. They're actually federal units. The parent agency is the USGS, and their primary role is to serve the state agencies and their needs. And we are cooperators as an agency with the USGS co-op units. And so we get a lot of work done with those folks as well. So with that, in the interest of time, I'll try to stop sharing.
Thank you, Jerry. All right, Commissioner Baker, I'll turn it back to you.
Well, I do have a question before the three science directors leave. First off, it's always kind of humbling to watch these kind of presentations and just realize how much work is done to buttress, you know, not only what the agency staff do, but what we do. This is an off the wall question that I've asked a couple of times lately. Between among the three kind of buckets that you all represent, there's a very wide divergence about how much face time we get with the scientists that are doing the work for the policies we're trying to figure out what the best answer is. And I gotta say, in the fish program, we deal with scientists all the time. And sometimes my eyes roll back in my head because we're doing with these really complicated models. And I think maybe one or two of us really get them. But just like the last presentation we had on hatchery policy with Ken Warhite, I mean, even Molly she interrupted twice to say it was amazing that she actually really, really understood the spreadsheet or the flow chart. But with wildlife, I also want to say one other thing. There are very controversial issues embedded in all these buckets. You guys know that better than me. Wildlife, we don't actually see the scientists on the ground in front of us very often. And habitat, Tim, I want to let you know that since during your presentation, I got 2 texts from people who are watching this to say, man, he's great. So it's really good for us to see you. But could you just comment a little bit about the best way for us to access your staff and whether and how comfortable they feel coming and addressing the full commission?
Tim, you want to start?
Sure. You can thank my son for at least one of those messages about he's great.
yeah, right.
My staff would love nothing more than to come and talk with you. We do a lot of work, and I think we have shown a lot of improvement in terms of the products that the Habitat program tries to cover in the state. Like I was saying, telling you about the adaptive management program of the HPA program. We are a small section, which probably explains why we're not in front of you very much. And I would like to say that we don't cause any conflict and everybody just believes what we say.
Yeah.
It may not be quite that simple, but our folks would love an opportunity to tell you what we do and how it aids the agency in practicing wise management in an ever increasing or ever shrinking world of natural resources. So thank you for that.
Thanks. I guess I'd like a short comment from each of you. Lori, I've already said you have made your staff as available as apparently we need. I sure see a lot of them, but what do you think about that question?
Yeah, I think our scientists are ready, willing, and able to come, you know, speak with you and present. Again, we are working to answer the policy or management questions that are asked from the decision makers, such as yourselves, that you need information on. And I'd like to think, you know, Ken Warhite's a really good example of that iterative process that that Amy described in her presentation of that policy science interface. And especially, I mean, I'm really proud of the work that he's done with Dr. McIsaac on the hatchery policy review process. And they've literally been just back forth and working together. And I just have been proud of that. So I welcome more opportunities like that and to really address your questions and the trade-offs you're weighing and try to quantify those with whatever science we can give you, especially on the biological side, right? But I think that human dimension side of the trade-offs and different values you're having to weigh and consider, maybe a human dimension scientist is what we need more of too in wildlife and fish and habitat to provide you with information on that side of things anyway. But we welcome more opportunities to work with you all for sure.
Thanks. Thanks, Lori. Commissioner McIsaac, Don has his hand up. And did you want to let Jerry go first, Don, or did you have a question specifically for Lori?
I couldn't hear. I kind of have a question for the group of them and maybe Amy and maybe for discussion amongst the commissioners here, too. So if there's a follow up on that thought, let me hold.
Well, thanks. Let's hear quickly from Jerry.
Okay, thank you. I have several points on the topic. For one, it was brought up earlier that, you know, in general, we don't do a very good job of self-promotion. And so we talk about that a lot within my division, how we can get do a better job of letting folks know what we're up to and all of our accomplishments and the great things that we do. Because we're a bunch of biologists and scientists and ecologists, we're not very good at self-promotion. But one possibility would be to provide topics and issues that folks are working on, and the commission might be able to pick and choose from some of those things that they would like to receive briefings on. Our folks would be happy to talk about any of the topics that they're working on anytime the commission would like. The other thing I would mention is that even though it might not appear that our scientists and science division aren't in front of you routinely, we really are, because we are a service division. And so when you're hearing from the game division, when you're hearing from the lands division, when you're hearing from the diversity division, there's always almost a connection back to the science division where we're supporting those folks to get to the end products that they're producing and presenting to you at the commission meetings. So we're always there behind the scenes, but we're happy to be up in front as well. So if there are topics that we can provide information on, we'd be more than happy to.
Thank you so much. Don, do you want to go ahead with your question?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Let me first add my compliments to all the groups here that are leading a bunch of very impressive talent and all the good scientists that are out there. I'm a little more familiar with the fish folks that Laurie Peterson has talked about and showed on her piece of paper. And I completely agree with her about what kind of advancements over the past 20 years there have been in the state of fishery science emanating from our agency. And it's just great to see that. And it's great to work with somebody like Dr. Warhite, who not only can translate between deep science into regular simple thought, but he can throw in some Gaelish quotes and have a good Scottish brogue to it as well. So my question has to do with this topic of the science policy interface. And in the spread of science between some casual scientific observations to some science-based modeling to some experimental approaches with controls and experimental treatments that continue to have repetitive answers that are the same, there's a strength of science spectrum there. And so when the commissioners hear from people testifying that they don't like where the commission might be going because the commission's not following the science or abandoning the science, and they speak to what might be the lower spectrum of the scientific quality as absolutely known science, and others who make claim that we should be using some sounder science before making a decision, it's very useful to have our experts here put some definition as to the quality of the science, where there's scientific uncertainty, and the science just isn't really known, and it is an open question, and there's not certainty there, and the folks that claim there is, you know, commissioners should know when some of what we hear is accurate and when it's not quite. So I'm not sure how to phrase this. I would just say there's a need out there, I think, at the front table of the commissioners to hear from our experts as to the soundness of science. When is it sound enough for in the case of fishery, when is it sound enough for fishery management decision making? And when is it so uncertain that maybe pursuing down that road is not a solid place to go? The ice might be thinner than you think. So I'm not sure when how to deal with that. But this topic is the science policy interface, and I would just recognize that there's a need for a little more definition. We've certainly got the talent, and I think we've got a receptive group of commissioners to try to get it. And but sometimes it comes up pretty quick, and there's a decision that has to be made or should be made, or it's appropriate to be made. And I guess I would, I'm glad to hear this conversation. Would like to see these offers that we're here for you guys to come to bear. And so that's why I don't know if this question is for Amy, if it's for other commissioners. I think we've heard from these leads on our science groups that they're willing. We certainly know they got the talent, and I'll just throw that out as a long-winded kind of question, I guess.
Well, Amy has her hand up, so let's see if she can give you a short-winded answer.
I think what you are touching on is the failed metaphor of follow the science and the challenge of people picking and choosing science to represent and allow the science to be a proxy for the values. And in my mind, the values conversation has to precede the science conversation. It has to sort of lay out, this is where we want to go. This is why I want to go there. This is the stakeholders and what they want from us. And this is why I'm choosing to explore this direction. You know, like there's a side of that that policy sort of has to pick up and not allow the picking and the choosing of the science to be the proxy debate for what's actually a values conversation. And so I see that, I think globally, we see that a lot with climate change, you know, where it's really an economic argument, perhaps, you know, that's really where people are struggling, but they pick and choose the science to sort of, to have the proxy debate. So I offer that as sort of an idea. And I think the other point that you make, and I wanna call out two different efforts going on right now in the Habitat Program and the Wildlife Program about the certainty of science. Tim's organizing a group to look at in-stream flow and what we know and what we don't know. And that's exactly what that team is doing, is trying to understand what does the science tell us about these future conditions. And Tim, maybe I'm mischaracterizing, so fix it up. And then Jerry's also doing something really similar with the cougar science, right? Like what's solid and what's not solid? What's the range of certainty in the science that we have? So Commissioner McIsaac, you've really hit on sort of a core piece of it that we got to wrestle with.
Well, thank you, Amy. So our time is about up. I hope people can stick with us for another few minutes. We have four hands up now, and I have one other topic that I at least just want to introduce. But as you can tell, all of you, there's some interest in this. Commissioner Kuntz, did you have a question?
Well, I wanted to follow up and build on what Don said, which I thought was really well said. And, you know, the thing with values, Amy, is if you're the one making the decision, it's great. Okay. It's like, yeah, I like that idea. But, you know, as a commissioner, I think good governance, we have to always be sorting out these decisions along what is the common interest? What is the common interest? And safeguard against making decisions based just on special interests. And so that's why I think it's so important that not just the commissioners hear more from the scientists, but that when we're having these policy decisions, that the public hears from the scientists too, and they get to start to build trust in seeing their expertise and seeing the nuances that they present. So that then when the commissioners have the tough job of, you know, defining what the common interest is, you know, without taking away from people's individual liberty and, you know, being sensitive to them, you know, I think with time, they'll start to have a better feeling that they might not get the decisions they want, but that we're making the decisions from the common interests and not any threat of special interests.
Thanks for that, Fred. That's a great observation. I think Commissioner Thorburn has her hand up, and then Jeff Davis.
Thank you. So I wanted to share sort of my recent experience on the issue of uncertainty that Don raised, some thinking that I've been doing about it. And it came up with the discussion about regulation of the whale watching for the southern resident killer whales. And we often heard that the technical panel recommended the precautionary principle. And that was the direction that we went, acknowledging that there was uncertainty over one sort of scientific question that kept coming up, and that was the role of the whale watchers in sort of the protecting the whales, and asked for we asked for more information about that and asked that it be studied as the rule progresses. And my approach to this was the southern resident killer whale is, as we all know, critically endangered. And so we can't tolerate a lot of uncertainty. We need to be precautionary when we're dealing with that kind of population. There are other decisions that we make where we're dealing with basically sustainable populations, healthy populations, where I'm comfortable tolerating a lot more uncertainty in the science. So just that kind of gets at that value question that that Amy alluded to in response to Don's observation and question. And I just wanted to share sort of the thinking that I've been doing and approach that I think is appropriate in terms of how much uncertainty is tolerable in policymaking.
Thanks for that, Kim. Jeff, did you have a question or a comment?
Just a super quick comment. I don't know the fish science or the wildlife science funding as well as I know Tim's science funding. And I just wanted to put out there, like oftentimes the best people at tracking down money are the science division staff. You know, that's great, and that can result in a lack of flexibility to answer the types of questions that the agency might have. They're good at fitting in the work to make sure that there's value that comes out of that for the agency. But I just want to put a plug out there that, in my opinion, our science divisions need a lot more of our general fund or our direct money if we're going to ask them to take on more of the answering the questions that are in front of us policy-wise.
That is the earmarking is an issue, isn't it? Amy has a response or a comment now.
I'll be fast. I think one of the outcomes of this work after we figure out this science policy framework is to understand what are the pressing policy questions that we need to develop science for. And with that would come one of the dreams that with that would come kind of a science agenda, a DFW science agenda that would be interdisciplinary, would have buy-off from our partners, the co-ops, the universities that we're partnered with. Like it would be a document that we could collectively say, we're going to invest here, which would then allow Nate to go out to the legislature and gather all the coins that they're willing to give us.
You know, I was thinking about that. I was thinking about the breadth of what we've covered in the last hour and a half. And of course, our challenge is to kind of know as much as we can know and continue to move forward wherever forward is. But beginning with Nate and his observations regarding the strategic plan and the funding and the budget, and then Rob going through the priorities of the near-term actions. By the way, Rob, please remember to send that to us because I didn't get it all written down. And then going through the science analysis, I mean, I do wish that the whole, you know, and then listening to commissioners who are real thoughtful, like, well, all three, Don, Fred, and Kim, talking about how science is part and parcel of the decisions that we have to make. And we do have to trust. This is a really good committee. And we take on some pithy stuff. So on that, Lorna, I see your hand up. I'll be right there, but I do want to finish what I'm going to say. We've been, for this meeting, we are over time. We had to ask Carrie McCausland to postpone a presentation she wanted to give us about the school curriculum work that we're doing. And I know how well received that has been, and just what a great service that is to kids. We might as well get them while their little captive audiences in front of their computers, although we all hope that doesn't last very long. So we are going to have another big tent committee meeting on or around, you know, somewhere close to the next commission meeting. I've skipped a couple because the strategic plan was such a heavy lift and we got all this other stuff, mainly fish stuff and wildlife stuff, backed up. But I'm not going to skip them for a while now because we really need to tackle the wither and then what's of a commission conservation policy and what that should entail. And that's going to be another big project. We also need to talk a bit about the mission statement and then follow up on these conversations. And that's already, so already we have a full plate for next meeting. I'd like to offer to members of the committee, if you have items you'd like to have us go into, please let me know. And I'm particularly interested in the conservation policy issue that we need to take on. And we need to get going with it because it's not going to be a quick thing. There are many components to it. So that's our preview of the next meeting. Lorna, you have your hand up.
Just a quick comment that we heard from these scientists within the agency doing such great work, but there's a gap that we need to think about, and that's the whole social science side of things. You know, our agency is going through a lot of changes. We're seeing our constituents change, focus on how people want to recreate around wildlife changing. And we also, because we're, you know, people are building houses continually in wildlife habitat and how do we coexist with wildlife? Those are all kind of social science questions. So I'm not saying we should necessarily bring that in-house, but we need to have access to that kind of science and to get those kind of questions answered so that our public outreach and education and our services match what all of our constituents really would like to see.
Thank you, Lorna. That's a great point. And I'm not sure if Nate's going to address it, but his hand just went up and so did Jerry Nelson's.
Great. Well, thanks, Madam Vice Chair and Commissioner Smith. The as part of the RFP and as we do that kind of gap analysis internally, the social sciences is definitely an area that we know is a gap. We have invested in different surveys on values, but now it's a matter of how do we incorporate some of that information into our decision-making and whether that's bringing on a human dimension specialist, is that bringing on training for our staff, or is that something where we contract it out? And I know where Jerry's going to go next. So Jerry, if we were sitting in the room, I'd slip you a note that says UW co-op unit. So I'm hoping that's what you're talking about.
Thanks, Nate. Jerry Nelson.
Yeah, Nate is right. I just wanted to put in a little plug. So as a cooperator with the co-op unit, the co-op units typically have one unit leader and two assistant unit leaders. Recently, the fish side of the co-op unit hired an assistant unit leader, and that's been going great. Now we are currently in the process of hiring a wildlife assistant unit leader, but in this particular case, and I'm helping with that. I'm co-chairing that recruitment with the Dr. Sarah Converse, who is the co-op unit leader. The unique thing about this is the wildlife assistant unit leader is going to be a human dimensions of wildlife and natural resources. And so that process is underway. The first round of interviews have been completed. The committee has narrowed the field down to four very good candidates. And in the not too distant future, we will have an assistant unit leader that if we're interested in prioritizing and directing resources that way, we will have a human dimensions specialist at the co-op unit to help us out with some things.
Thanks so much, Jerry. Does anybody else have closing comments for this meeting? Commissioner Kuntz.
I just wanted to say as my first meeting on this Big Ten committee, I enjoyed it very much. And I really look forward to the future discussion that Barbara outlined, especially about developing a conservation policy, because I really think it's timely. And I look forward to that very much and thank everybody.
Thank you. Well, you know, I guess putting too many accolades and pats on the back, it gets tiresome, but you know, it really is humbling to look at the amount of work that's done by the people who support us. And it's good to be reminded too. So thanks to the three of you, thanks to Amy and then the strategic plan team. It's been a good meeting for me. So with that, I'm going to adjourn it and we can all go off and have our last hour of, well, rain, but sunshine. Okay. See you guys.